Welcome into the hours. It is another edition of our podcast, which you can find now in an RSS feed, and you can also find in our community. So each week in our Savvy Coaching community, we will drop the link to our YouTube episode, which is probably the best place to find it. But like I said, you can find it anywhere where you find your podcast. Tyler, we're going to jump into the big question this week. And I'm really interested about this because this is something that has been debated over and over. And I think my stance on this has probably changed over the years. So big question for you. Should we shoot free throws in practice?
As always, multi-part answer. And I'll answer this in my answer to this. I'll give in three parts. No, yes, or what's a free throw? You started laughing right as I said no.
Well, you said no, yes, and then what's a free throw? So you have me on the edge of my seat.
Okay, good. All right, no. If we're associating the traditional way of shooting free throws, which is like, okay, everybody go get to your basket and shoot a set of 10 free throws. No, I think that's a waste of time. You get very little traction out of it. It's both too much time and too little time. It's too much time because, you know, any amount of time you spend shooting free throws there is wasted. So if it's like a 5 to 10 minute breather in your practice, you could probably get a lot more leverage because you're getting very little traction from 5 to 10 minutes of just block free throw shooting practice. So if that's how you're thinking about, should we shoot free throws, then no. And I know that that's like often a frustration point for us as coaches. Like we missed a bunch of free throws in our last game. Well, we had better do something about it. Okay. So that would then translate into the yes. Okay. You should do something about it. It's very important to be able to make free throws. So you should shoot free throws in practice. So then how should we shoot free throws in practice? The S in Savvy stands for simplicity wins. And I think this is a really good way to look at and think about simplicity. Well, how should we do something in practice? How does it happen in a game? In games, free throws happen as part of the game, not as a separate portion of the game. So no, if you have this completely separate block where we're just going to shoot free throws, but yes, if you want to begin validating all competitive wins with a free throw, if you want to start shooting free throws on foul calls within your competitive games, or if you want to incorporate free throws into your shooting system. Now you can find a lot of information on our shooting system, both in our school community and in our classroom. But a shooting system is an organized way to approach your marathon shooting development over a long period of time. And so one aspect of our shooting system is how we apply this concept of a competitive cauldron to shooting. We call it the shooting ladder. And so instead of being like, oh, now let's just go shoot free throws that don't really mean much, that are, you know, 10 in a row, you're never gonna shoot 10 free throws in a row. Most often you'll shoot one or two free throws in a row based on the rules set that you're playing with. But the reason players miss free throws in games is most often pressure. And so we need to shoot free throws with pressure or else we're not really improving our shooting of free throws. So you do that by putting into the games, to validate the games, or to do it in a competitive way that will move someone up and down a ladder that's very, very visible because that adds pressure to it. So that would be the yes. No, if you're doing it traditionally. Yes, if you're doing that way. And now I'll say the maybe answer. Well, maybe. If a player is a poor shooter, shooting free throws is actually just a great way to tune up their shot in general. It's a very advantageous distance. It's usually much slower. It's shooting with a lot less speed than any other type of shot that they'll have to take in regular gameplay, which allows them to improve their form. So if they're early in their shooting journey, then I would say, yeah, that's a good thing to put into their individual shooting development. But if they're further along in their shooting journey, they're a good shooter, you don't really need to shoot many free throws anymore. That's not the shot that you really need to practice. You need to shoot shots that are a little bit more game-like that require different types of footwork and movement and a lot more speed. And so that would be like the individual thing. It's like, okay, where are they in the shooting journey? If it's a young shooter, like working with my 11 and 9-year-old daughters, they need to shoot a lot of free throws. They're very early in their shooting journey. That's a great place for them to tune up their shot. Me, if I'm making my comeback in Masters FIBA 3-on-3, I'm not going to spend any time practicing free throws. I'm going to go to the line and knock down my free throws at about an 85 to 90% rate, no matter what I do. So that's kind of where the maybe answer comes in.
Yeah, all really good. I'll talk about nothing really to add or nothing to push back on. I'll just add a couple points that I thought of as you were going through yours. We want to make practice as representative of the game as possible, like you said. You're never going to shoot volume free throws, and I've never seen any evidence that says shooting volume free throws correlates to making free throws in the game, because one, there's no such thing as muscle memory. But I think shooting volume free throws could just give you maybe the internal confidence of like, gosh, I've shot hundreds and thousands of free throws. I've done this over and over. So maybe that might be more of a psychological benefit of shooting volume free throws. But I would argue don't do that in practice because it takes too much time. Like you said, there was a graphic that was floating around on Twitter that had Dwight Howard, who we all know is a horrific free throw shooter, shot, I think he made 85% of his free throws in practice. And this is when he was playing for the Lakers. So they had this chart where I guess it was like one of those training camp things that they'll show on NBA TV. And they had somebody got a screenshot and it's like he had made 85% and he's like a below 50% free throw shooter in the game. So that's just evidence that volume free throw shooting probably doesn't translate. Ways we can make it more representative would be shoot two at a time, put some pressure on. Like when we play pickup, you know, and you lose, it's like, all right, we're shooting for two. Well, I feel the pressure because I love to play and I don't want to sit. So I'm like, all right, well, this feels more like a game free throw because something's on the line. So can we put something on the line? And I found when we shoot volume free throws, players are usually talking, not paying attention, not going through their game routine. And it just feels different. So I loved what you said about validating. Let's put something on the line. And I will also throw this, and I think this is a Morgan Wooten thing that I saw years and years ago. He said, don't talk about free throws. If anything, it highlights to your team, especially when you're a poor free throw shooting team, that you are a poor free throw shooting team. That kind of manifests itself within your team, especially I think when as coaches, we put pressure on our players to make free throws because we are a quote unquote badge free throw shooting team. We add even more pressure to a often pressure situation. So
that's interesting. I've not heard that before. That's good.
Yeah. And I've experimented with this. So we would shoot maybe volume free throws before or after practice, very little free throws during practice. Sometimes it would be, hey, go make two free throws and get water. But then we kind of did away with water breaks altogether. And we didn't shoot free throws, just, you know, and I don't think I would have to go back and look, but I would guess on years where we shot free throws either before, after, or during practice, in years where we just didn't shoot them, other than if the practice called for it, like a foul or something, I don't think our percentages were any different. And if they were, it was minimal. And I don't think the practice time shooting free throw was the difference. I think it also goes, like you said, poor shooters shooting free throws is almost a way to tune their shot. If you have a good shooting team, you're probably going to be a good free throw shooting team. Right. Yeah, and I do think there's the mental element where you got to prepare them for pressure games and all that. But I think if you're running a games-based approach in practice, you should be getting those by calling fouls and lining up and shooting real free throws.
Yeah, and before we segue into the mailbag section, I was meeting with a coach. I had coffee with the coach yesterday morning. And I'm sharing this because, first, for anyone that's listening, thank you for listening. I have a ton of respect for you investing in yourself. There's so many things that we can consume and is so readily available in today's world. But if you really are trying to master the craft of coaching, I really think that this is a great investment of your time, because everything that we share on the hours, and this is really our vision for the hours, is connected to everything else that we share on the hours. It really is a paradigm. So everything comes back to this principle of a games-based approach. If it happens in the game, we want to get good at it. If it doesn't, we don't. How do we get good at it? By trying to replicate and concentrate on an area of the game as it happens in the game. And so the answers to these big questions always zoom out to the same principle. And our hope, our goal, and you choosing to spend hours with us talking basketball, talking coaching in general, is that it can continually move your mindset and shift your lens to seeing the game in a certain way, this way that we call being savvy. And so I just love that every big question comes back to core beliefs. And, you know, I'll just end with this, is there's gonna be so many times throughout your coaching careers that you're going to be asked, do you truly believe what you say you believe? You're going to be asked that by the decisions that you make. You're going to be asked that by how you handle challenges and adversity. You're going to be asked that in moments in a game when you have to make a decision of who are we playing? How are we playing? What adjustment do we make? It all is going to come back to how your beliefs play out in your leadership. So I just was reminded of that because I didn't think of that initially when the question came up. Hey, should you shoot free throws in practice? But it really did remind me of that. And so I really encourage everyone that is interacting with this, continue to lean into it if this is what you think is the right way to do things, because there's numerous, countless ways that it actually plays out.
Yeah, really good. You talk about shifting lens. We often talk about you don't need a new drill. Or, you know, you need to change your approach. And what we challenge coaches to do is to change their approach to principle-based or values-based, right? So principle-based teaching, even values-based, like you said, do you truly believe in what you preach? That's values-based, right? We're going to make decisions based on our values. So we make 1, 2, 3 decisions on what we value, what principles we choose to teach, and it saves us from making hundreds of decisions during the season, which is... sign up clarity and simplicity. So cool. All right. I got a mailbag question for you as we shift over to the mailbag segment here. The community has been awesome, man. I know you've seen it, but the engagement has been great. A lot of offensive questions coming in this week, and have one about race and space. It says, it seems there's more of an emphasis on implementing 2-man actions before your 3-man or unicorn actions. Is that true? And if so, why?
I'm going to flip this one right back to you and ask you, because I have an answer and I think that Evan picked up on it, but I don't know your answer. Where would you start? 2-man or 3-man actions? And if so, why?
We would start with 2. Only because that's where Rose series, that's kind of the engine that we flow, you know, the engine of the offense, we flow into Rose series, which tends to be 2-man action, but can turn into 3-man. Honestly, I've never thought of prioritizing either, but I just think most of the actions that I have leaned on would be 2-man actions, unless we're counting the ball. Like, would split action be 3-man action? Because you got a ball handler in 2 in a screen. If so, then honestly, I don't ever look at it that way of like, are we prioritizing 2-man actions or 3-man actions? I just look at it as, what actions do I like? What do we think create advantages the easiest way? And does that fit into our core offense?
Yeah, no, I agree. So I would say that I also prioritize 2-man actions over 3-man actions. And my why might be a little bit different. Here's my biggest why. It's quicker to implement, I've found. So anytime we train, you don't need as many players, because we want to try to have, whenever we train in action, we want to have some bones out there, right? This is the whole bones over cones idea. Cones is just air, space, right? We want to do as much as we can. You can't do everything. We want to do as much as you can with bones over cones. And so when you have limited numbers and you want to prioritize repetitions for people, more people get more touches and more reps in 2-man actions. Also, it requires less organization and coordination. So not only can we get more reps, we're going to get more effective reps with two-man actions because there's less people you can mess it up. When you introduce a third body, there's actually a really interesting science fiction book called The Three-Body Problem. It just made me think of that. Anyway, I won't go into that. When you introduce a third body to any system, it introduces more randomness and confusion and whatnot. And so it's harder for us to actually get reads. And then the last reason I like two-player actions is I find that the best way to move from addition to multiplication on your actions is to just introduce two-player actions, and then you multiply your options out of it and what it can look like. Whereas it's impossible in a 5-on-5 game to combine 2 3-player actions because that's 6 players and we don't have 6 players. So those would be all my reasons in order to why I would prioritize 2-player actions over 3-player actions. Yeah, I think that's probably all I'd have to say about that.
Yeah, well said. And I do agree with just 2-man actions being easier. That's probably why we've leaned on that early without even knowing it, you know, just kind of subconsciously doing that. All right. Another question I have for you. We just talked offense. Let's go defense here. I have a coach that reached out. He's a Grow member, sent me a DM. He runs a pressing system. And I guess to simplify this pressing system, let's say make or miss, they're getting into this press. And players are assigned, much like our transition defensive system in lock left, they're assigned roles and areas on the floor. So they have, you know, a pointer that always is going to take the ball, right? Or it's going to, the initial shape will be kind of like a 1-2-2, just to give you a visualization there. But we just match up with the player closest to us in the zone. So it's kind of like a matchup zone in a lot of ways. This coach is switching the lock left this year. And he asked me, can we combine the press that I run with lock left in the full court? My initial answer was, if your pointer, the top of the 1-2-2, would also be your wolf, then yes. And your tigers could be, you know, what he would call the setters that kind of line up at the elbows to start. So he said, kind of a more aggressive version could be when the ball is thrown in, we just lock it left, but we keep our initial pressing system. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, and then I may or may not have a follow-up after you go.
What's the name of this pressing system? What do they call it?
You know, I don't know. It comes from, you know, Birmingham Southern College, which is a D3 that actually just shut down, ran it for years. I mean, I'm thinking like the last 20 to 25 years I've been running the system. So it's just kind of grown in that area. Mm-hmm. But to be honest, it's kind of just like what the system is, you know, it's like, it's the press that we all run. I don't know that's a name.
Gotcha. Cool. So yeah, short answer is yes. And the medium answer is yes. And everyone should do it. And the longer answer is, align your full court pressure with your half court system, with your conservative system. I think that that's the ideal, is like, you want all these things aligned. All you do is just turn the dial of how much pressure, how far you're going to extend. So the only thing that would limit in the lock left, our wolf sounds just like the pointer, and use any words that you want, whatever, but the player that's going to pick up the ball and dictate the side of the floor that the ball is going to go to for us to pressure, trap it, not trap it, whatever. The only limit on where that person picks up the ball, how far out, and the level of pressure that they apply, the only limit is their skill set. Like the goal of the lock left is that the wolf gets the ball as early as possible and does everything that they can to get the ball going towards jail. So we played a game last night with our teams, and I had 4 teams of 4. We had 16 players last night, 4 teams of 4, and each team of 4 had a wolf. Our best wolf, Malia, I was requiring and challenging her to be on the ball immediately every single possession. Our weakest wolf, I won't share their name, our weakest wolf, I just said, hey, by half court, you had better be directing that ball left, because they just didn't have the same level of speed, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say that a full court press is just the natural outcome of developing stronger defenders with a greater skill set. I would say absolutely get it done. It's going to be better when you're pushing them left. And as far as like alignment, a 1-2-2 or a 1-2-1-1 or a 1-3-1, any of those alignments work as long as you just designate what role is going to what area on the floor and matches up. I mean, I think the greatest similarity between this full court pressing system and the lock left role based system is we're matching up from an area and a responsibility, as opposed to you always have number five. That's probably the biggest philosophical shift for a lot of defensive coaches into the lock left, is we're not designating who you're guarding, we're designating what you're guarding. And that sounds really, really similar.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say it's very similar to that. We ran this pressing system kind of sparingly, and it's exactly that. Get to your spot, you know, get to your role, and then and then you defend out of that.
Love it.
Good. Well said, man. All right, let's take one more mailbag. I like this question. I'll go first on this one. Please. I've been putting you on the spot. So what are some important stats or charts that assistant coaches could or should be keeping during games? And he also says what roles for each, let's say five assistants. I'll just kind of answer this more broad. What do you want to know, right? Like, what's going to impact your decision? What impacts your decision should be what impacts winning. There are the four factors of the game. You have turnover percentage, effective field goal percentage, rebounding percentage, and then the free throw factor. Those are kind of Dean Oliver's four metrics that have been made real popular. At the high school level, the number one metric that determines winning and losing is turnover percentage. I would say maybe even at the college level. I know a lot of Dean Oliver's stats go from college NBA. At the NBA, it's effective field goal percentage because they hardly ever turn the ball over in the NBA. So I would want to know what factors are going in, or how can we measure turnovers, right? I want to know at the end of the first quarter who's winning the turnover battle. And if we're losing the turnover battle, is it something they're doing or is it something we're doing, right? Do we have to prevent losing first before we start to win the game? I would also want to know effective field goal percentage. And we've talked a lot about our shot scale. I think that would, a possession chart would be really valuable of what types of shots are we getting? Are we getting big advantage shots? Are we settling for small advantage or neutral shots? Meaning we have a big advantage shot available. We're just not making one or two extra passes to find it. Or are they forcing us in? And the best shot that we can create is small advantage. And that might mean we got to change our approach. And then rebounding, would want to know just who's winning the rebounding battle, because rebounding can greatly influence your effective field goal percentage. Offensive rebound putbacks, your second, third chance points are obviously going to be higher percentage. And then all these things are kind of intertwined, not just rebounding effective field goal percentage, but turnover percentage, right? If we're forcing live ball turnovers, then that's going to help our effective field goal percentage because we're probably getting easy baskets in transition. So I say all that to say I would focus on the four factors, but I would also do what we can, not try to do something that's overly complicated. I had a similar conversation with a coach recently, and he said, you know, we kept this chart, but we couldn't really get the data in real time. So it wasn't really valuable till after the game. So I'm like, well, nix that chart, right? Simplify that chart to where you can say, you know, it might be as easy as somebody track the amount of possessions that we have. And we can always look at the score and do simple division and know what points per possession are we at, right? So I would say, what can you keep? And then, like kind of what your staff allows you to keep, and then can we simplify to get the four factors? Shot chart would be another way to measure effective field goal percentage.
Yeah, that's good. The only addition I would make is I would hone in on the turnover piece when measuring that, and when you identify that, that's a huge warning sign and probably where I would suggest you start to improve your effectiveness. And I'll relate that very specifically to the race and space offense. In order to lower turnovers, I highly, high, I mean, it's why I designed the roles the way I did in Race and Space was coming out of this as a top priority. How can we continue to play fast and yet not turn the ball over a lot? Like that's the biggest kind of a challenge, right? Good things come from playing fast. It improves our effective field goal percentage. Bad things come from playing fast. You could turn the ball over a lot more. And so, gosh, there's so many things we could talk about this, but I'll go very high level and simple. Personnel will do more to impact your turnover rate than development or anything you can say to someone in the moment. Who's doing what, when, and can you move those pieces around? And so I would just encourage you, if you're a Race and Space coach, or if you're leaning into Race and Space, think of your racker as your engine and your dragon as your brakes. Your racker is your engine, your dragon is your brakes. So if our racker is driving us to speed and attacking and getting to the rack and hunting, well, that also means that's probably a player that's gonna be a little bit more turnover prone, especially when they run into better defensive teams or they're a little bit outmatched or whatever. And so when identifying who your dragon is, they're your kind of safety valve. And lean into that. At any point, if the racker is getting pressure, out of control, not getting anything, it's the dragon's job when the ball touches their hands, and for them to be the most available second player to touch the ball, everything slows down. Right? The ball touches their hands. We can all take a deep breath. That type of player is strong with the ball, makes great decisions, doesn't get out of control, plays a lot slower. And so everyone can take a breather. And so then in an actual game situation, if you're committing a lot of turnovers, if the team's pressuring you, whatever, the only adjustment I'd make is I'd go to my racker and be like, hey, the moment you cross half, the dragon touches the ball. That's it. Just get the ball out of the racker's hands into the dragon's hands. Because you can't tell your racker to be a different player in the moment, right? It's just you, all you do is you just impact time of possession. Like, who has more possession of the basketball in your offense? Do you need more engine or do you need more breaks? And your racker and dragon should be your two best decision makers. So you want the ball in their hands and out of the hands of everybody else. So that's kind of a little bit of a connection to that one aspect of what you want to measure and how to impact it.
I'll add this one thing too. We all know, we all heard stats can lie. So just knowing, oh, we have, it's halftime and we have 10 turnovers, and that's entirely too many. I always wanted to know, well, when or where are we turning the ball over at? So in our possession chart, we would know if our turnovers came from transition, early offense, which is kind of that moment in between transition and half court offense, or half court offense. Because if 7 of those 10 turnovers came out of half court offense, what's like, well, we really need to emphasize transition, because when we get half court, we're in trouble. Same thing with our shot selection. If we have, a ton of nines and sevens in the first half, well, that's great, but where are we getting those? Are those all coming in transition? Are they all coming in the half court? Are we settling for fives in transition and need to clean that up? So, as detailed as you can be in the stats that matter, I would say fewer metrics to chart, but go deeper into what you are charting, because that's going to give you a more realistic view of the game. Let's transition to game of the week. I'll share a quick one here. And then if you want to take the teach better for us today, Tyler. So, one way we talked, the big question was free throws, and we talked about making those representative of the game. One game that we played in practice a good bit, especially when we wanted to practice our press, was what we called 5-on-5 and 1. So, in the video here, we just got a bucket. It was not an and one. It was an offensive rebound putback. No one was fouled. You can actually see players getting to the next play. But every made basket, I blow the whistle and we call and one, which means every single basket, we're going to line up and shoot one free throw. That's going to give us a chance for this player to shoot a game-like free throw. We have built-in free throw rebounding, which oftentimes gets neglected in practice. And then it gives us a chance to set up our press or work against a press. This was a year where we didn't press a lot. So we played 5-on-5 and 1. just to give us a built-in kind of a easy way to work against pressure, where I didn't have to just build a pressure segment. We're really working on ourselves, but we know any made basket is going to be an opportunity to shoot game-like free throws and work against our press, work our press break against that press. And the players actually love it, just because they get to work on their N1 celebration, kind of get some energy in the gym. It's kind of different. So, I would recommend getting some 5-on-5 and one. There's a made three from the corner. So we're going to line it up and shoot. One side note too, in the previous clip, you can actually see it here. So these players running on, we always had players manage their own subs in practice, and they just subbed as a partner group. So right here, player 25 and 21 are partners. They're going to sub out a partner group. I didn't care who they got. They were all partnered up based on roles. So a racker was going to be paired with a racker. So we always knew two rackers were going into the game and were going to probably guard each other. Just a little side note on how we subbed. I felt like that was really efficient. Coaches could kind of take their hands off, and any dead ball players were allowed to sub.
I like it. I like it a lot. Any question that you have about how to focus on something or improve something, we'll continue to answer. Obviously, we can't get to all of them here in the hours, but we'll answer them in the hours. But more importantly, if you're a Grow member, that means we're going to answer your questions directly, and you'll get your direct messages answered. If you're a free community member, well, we might get to your question. Someone in the community will get to the question. But if you want to guarantee that Mark or myself will help you through your question with a quick fix like that, this is a reminder that we would invite you to join our community as a Grow member, a guaranteed year of growth. We're planning out the next year of your development with deep dives every single month into some aspect of coaching or system. And we take you through that with our cohorts and our group consulting. You get time with us weekly, but also you're prioritized for us to give you feedback, whether it be direct feedback or video feedback, a shot breakdown or whatnot. So if you have been around Savvy, I would just invite you to take advantage of a year of Grow. I guarantee that you'll be a different coach 1 year from now than you are right now. And for example, that being said, we'll finish up with the Teach Better segment here. And I'm actually going to answer a question I got from one of our Grow members. And I'm actually putting together a specific workout for this Grow member for their specific players. But I wanted to take this opportunity to answer this question here on the hours of, okay, how do I approach a player workout? I got some, she had some players that wanted to get in, get some extra work in. And so she's trying to develop a player workout that fits into and connects to her system. So this is the general template that I would encourage you use when you're developing a player workout. This is what I use, and this can be for a 20-minute workout or a 1-hour workout. And here's the steps. Then I'll go a little bit more into the steps and give some quick examples. But there will be more video being added in as we continue to bring more and more of our content into the classroom in our new school platform. Four steps that I take in a player workout. We go to finishing school, we do some bones work, we do some tune work, and then we do some action development. Finishing school, bones work, tune work, and action development. That's the progression. Now you can mix and match the order. The order doesn't necessarily matter. But again, going back to our principle and philosophy, we want to hunt nines first and seven second. So in order to get nines, that's why we do finishing work. It's how do we get and make nines? Bones work. Well, the majority of the times we get nines are going to come off of some sort of a hunt or a drive to the rim. Yeah, you can get some burn cuts or some putbacks or some bolts, but we don't need to practice that stuff, especially not in a player workout necessarily. So we're going to do some bones work where we're going to work on our ball handling in reaction to some bones, some actual reads and some defense. So we'll incorporate some ball handling with some bones work, because if you do ball handling without any reading, well, then you're not going to actually transfer it. They'll do some tune shooting because we have nines first and seven second. And as we're tuning up our shot, all we're trying to do is develop the ability to make sevens. Can you make off the catch threes? I mean, the majority of pros are spending the majority of their shooting time on just making stances off the catch threes. So if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for your high school team or college team or whatever it is that you're coaching. Then lastly, action development. So we're going to incorporate all of these things, right? Finishing, ball handling, shooting off of a game-based action. So that's the big picture. Okay, so now how do you decide what to do? Well, let me give you an example. So one specific question, or the specific question that I got from Latrice was, all right, I'm going to be working with my rabbit or my porch player. Well, I actually did a session with our porch player just yesterday. And when I was planning out her 1 hour workout, this is the answers that I came up with for the rabbit or the porch player, whatever you're calling this player. If you're, they're going to be in and the four out, one in. And this is what we chose to do. Finishing school. Her finishing school was just going to be a left shoulder jump hook. She didn't really have that finish. She can make a wide open nine, but off of offensive rebounds, off of like little mid posts, off of like rolls to the rim. If she gets chested, she didn't have anything to go to. So we just honed in off of all those scenarios, left shoulder jump hooks, a little bit of a shoulder fake, whatever. So we went to finishing school on that one finish. And the specific technique thing that we're working on was like, can we extend 3 more inches on her release point on her jump hook? Because most of the time it was right around her head. Like super simple, but like that's 4 or 5 more shots that are going to be uncontested per game. So then we went to her Bones ball handling. Well, for her, and again, Bones, you can go into our classroom if you want to go through the 5 different lenses that we look at for Bones. It's an acronym. I won't go into that now. That's a whole nother thing. But for her Bones ball handling, it was just, how does she catch the ball on a short roll and get herself to the smile? Right? So can she catch with the momentum change? Can she catch with the spin dribble? Like, and can she read chest or read shoulder? She's going through it. That was all her Bones were, right? With vision, body control, all the things that we go through. So we just worked on that, reading a defender. Then tune shooting, right? The only time she's going to shoot a three actually is if sometimes she gets into the dragon position in our transition. Because the dragon got out ahead of it. And so we wanted her to develop the ability to drag into a top of the key trail three. So all we did was we kind of built that out from working on her handprint from a couple of blaster shots, and then tuning it out to some load shots. All right, finally, action development. What action is this player going to be involved in the most, right? And so this player is going to be involved in 2 actions the most, some dribble handoffs and some step up screens. Both of which, because they're not yet a good shooter, have them rolling and catching into, on a short roll to the post and then trying to go and use these things that we did. So we have them catching off of short rolls on dribble handoffs and then going into their reads and finishes and catching off of short rolls on step-up screens and working on all of the skill sets. That's an individual player workout, and that's the lens through which I would encourage you to view all players. Your answers are going to be different based on what type of player they are. But that's a little overview for you, Latrice, specifically, and hopefully for everybody. Okay, what would I do for a porch player training session?
Yeah, really good. I love that. That was fun. And I think the best part, and I think coaches struggle with this with skill development, is connecting it to their role within team play. So we didn't just do 2-ball dribble and all these other things and hope that they translate into her role or his role as a porch or a rabbit. So, yeah. Good stuff, man. Well, appreciate you spending the time with us. If you're listening or watching, we always enjoy spending this time with you. I am going to, bump our mailbag, thread in our community. Feel free to drop in questions there. We'll hopefully get to it next week, but, thanks for spending this time with us.
And invite people to the community. We've only started, I don't know, 3 weeks ago, I don't know how long. We have over 400 coaches in the community, but we want every coach to be in this community because we want to have an impact. The coaches that say this, I don't understand. They're like, hey, keep it quiet that you're working with us. Right? And no, we are coaches because we want to help people, right? Like I understand that we all want to win. But the biggest win is that we all get better, right? And, a rising tide raises all boats. And so, like, if you're in this for the right reasons and you're trying to impact basketball, invite every coach you know. Coaches know coaches. Say, hey, check out this free community. So I would invite you to invite people to come and join our free community.
Yeah, lighting someone else's candle with yours doesn't take away your flame, right? I would also say this, trust in your ability to synthesize the information that you get and to apply it, because all the information is available to everybody. It's those who can actually learn and apply are the ones that make the biggest progress. I would also say this, limit the amount of sources you get information from. We hope that source is savvy. But if you get everything, you know, all these ideas, oftentimes it's in one ear, out the other. So we're glad you're here with us. We are Savvy Coaching. I'm Mark. He's Tyler. As always, stay savvy.